I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Vali Nasr's new book, The Dispensable Nation, was excerpted in Foreign Policy earlier this year and caused quite a stir. He had worked for Richard Holbrooke, who was President Obama's first special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, part of the State Department. Holbrooke believed in engagement, even with the Taliban. And Nasr writes, was ignored and undermined by aides in the Obama administration who cared more for politics than policy. Nasr describes the intense turf wars between the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department, and the CIA that he says have had a damaging effect on U.S. foreign policy. His book is subtitled American Foreign Policy in Retreat. He's dean of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Vali Nasr joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
So what was your job with Ambassador Holbrooke?
I was his senior advisor, and I worked on helping shape the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy that the administration had set as its agenda when it first came in order to address how we go forward with the Afghanistan war.
You describe Richard Holbrooke in this book, and clearly you are a great admirer of his, and mm-hmm. he died in the end of 2010. What did you like so much about him?
Well, first of all, he literally gave his life for this work. A man of 69, the amount that he traveled, the amount of hours that he put into this work, first of all, that dedication itself was admirable. But he was very talented and intelligent. He was very committed to a vision of America's leadership in the world, that America is a force for good and ought to deploy its resources to achieve that. He had a very good sense of history and in many ways was a student of history. And he had a very sharp strategic mind, and he had a knack for seeing the forest first before focusing on the trees and being able to see several steps ahead. I would say when it came to diplomacy, he was a very good chess player, being able to predict moves way down the game. And in many ways, he was a master, which was very good to watch at his craft.
And we should say very responsible for the Dayton Peace Accords going back to the 1990s.
And he had also been involved in the talks that ended the Vietnam War. He had been part of the Carter administration's opening with China and negotiations with Deng Xiaoping about normalization of relations. So he had been involved in many other diplomatic episodes in recent American history. And the pinnacle of his career, obviously, was the Dayton Accords.
So what was his vision for this region? And, of course, we're talking about what was and still is a very difficult and troubled part of the world, dealing with Afghanistan and Pakistan. What did he think was possible to be accomplished there?
Well, first of all, he thought it was a very critical region for the future of the United States and for its security. We had to get it right. And he also believed that the legacy of what we did in Afghanistan and Pakistan will inform the way that the world looked at us and looked at our power and looked at our leadership. So it went to essentially to our reputation. He believed that we should have had a longer run plan for Afghanistan that included or ended with some kind of a political settlement that would include all of the neighbors and stakeholders, and that would be a pretext for leaving. So he wanted us not to put as many troops as the military wanted.
The surge.
The surge, because he believed the more you surge, the quicker you're going to withdraw. That a surge is a sprint, whereas Afghanistan really needed a marathon. So he wanted to put fewer troops in, but that our presence would be sustainable and therefore credible. And then on the back of that, you would use that presence on the ground to really craft an agreement that would end the war, that would include Pakistan, Russia, China, India, Turkey, the Arab countries, even potentially Iran, but more than all, the Taliban and the Afghan government, and that you would end up with a negotiated and something like Dayton, something like the Bonn Agreement, which we arrived at after our first escapade into Afghanistan in 2001, 2002.
He also supported and believed in talking to the Taliban. Why?
Because a settlement means you talk to your enemy. I mean, you know, the two military forces in Afghanistan are the United States and the Taliban. the Afghan government and other European powers. There was a sort of embellishment on top of the war. Therefore, the negotiation for a ceasefire and an end to the hostilities and an end to the war has to be between the two main protagonists. So you either are going to defeat the other side completely, which he didn't believe would happen, and I think he's been proven right, and you don't want to abandon the fight either, which is what we're doing. So he thought we actually really ought to use our power on the ground while we have it to arrive at a deal, force the Taliban to sign on to a deal that also Pakistan and India and China and Russia would see as valuable enough to support as well.
How would you force? I mean, how did he imagine, though, forcing the Taliban to do anything?
Well, first of all, we had to have a credible presence on the ground. The Taliban and their backers, for instance, in Pakistan, had to believe that we're in this for the long run and we're not going to leave. Once they saw that reality, they may begin to calculate their hand differently. And then you would go around and talk to all the stakeholders in Afghanistan and actually get them to agree to a baseline that they all would see as reasonable and would protect their individual interests in an end game in Afghanistan. And then you would basically use that as the context to get the Taliban and the Afghan government to a negotiating table. And then it would be tough negotiations after that.
Let me ask you, though, and this is more a political question, but as we all know, the American public, not just tired of the wars, but feeling as if there is no solution, a viable near-term solution to some of the internal problems in a place like Afghanistan. And, you know, frankly, seeing American soldiers being killed, wanting the troops to come home, and the president sort of caught between a foreign policy and domestic concerns. Do you have sympathy for where he was at?
Well, I have sympathy for where he was at, and I know the forces that were on him. But in the end, I think he reacted to pressure domestically. So he first surged, which actually will tire the American public more. And he surged because he was in a position that he couldn't say no to a triumphant military that came out of Iraq, having really saved the day and had a strategy in a box called counterinsurgency, which is very heavy in terms of use of soldiers and money. So he said yes to that, even though he didn't want to say yes to that.
He was reluctant.
He was reluctant. And then he said, he basically very quickly turned around and said, I'm declaring victory and leaving. So in the end, you know, domestic considerations made us sort of a yo-yo out of our strategy of surging and then withdrawing. But in the end, we actually didn't really try to fundamentally put something in place that would not necessarily fix all the problems, but would provide a far better stability to the one that we're likely to leave behind when we leave in 2014.
You describe attempts by Richard Holbrooke to make this case to the White House, to try to appeal to the president, to his advisors on foreign policy. And I think the word you have, or the words you have, is a kind of Berlin Wall around the president, trying to get past the aides that, as you described, were more interested in the politics of a decision than the actual policy.
Yes, and I think there are many accounts of the strategic review, the so-called strategic review the president did, including Bob Woodward's book, which goes blow by blow. And you see that the two options that are in front of the president is either an all-in, which is a fully resourced counterinsurgency, or all-out, which is that we completely withdraw and then, you know, use drones and special forces to kill terrorists. But there was no option put before him that actually looked at a political settlement, an option that actually would have put the diplomats in charge of ending the war. Because the other two options put either the military or the CIA in charge of our policy, but Holbrooke's solution would have put the diplomats in charge. And that was never even considered. It was not on the table.
Quoting from Foreign Policy, which is an excerpt of your book, you write, the president had a truly disturbing habit of funneling major foreign policy decisions through a small cabal of relatively inexperienced White House advisors whose turf was strictly politics. Who are those advisors? Who are you talking about?
Well, there are many people who came out of the campaign with him that some have left, some are there. These were his close advisors. Some were in his inner circle. Some were actually members of the National Security Council. And they basically decided the options that the president would actually examine. So, you know, and also they had a view that they would decide on the policy, and then it was the job of the other agencies to merely implement these policies. And there was a particular initially bad blood with Holbrook, because during the campaign he had supported Secretary Clinton very aggressively. But also there was a sense among these young crowd that they had walked on water during the campaign. They had won big, and they knew much better than these old guard of the Democratic Party. There was almost a sort of a generational intolerance for experience and knowledge, and that sort of the tweeting young crowd really didn't have patience for people who would evoke Vietnam in a conversation.
Let me ask you, though, about then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, because she was able to negotiate with the president the fact that she could have weekly meetings with him and, I guess, get past this Berlin Wall, as you describe. Was she an advocate for the kind of policy that Richard Holbrooke was talking about?
She was an advocate for the White House taking it very seriously and for it be an option that is considered. She was also an advocate for many other policies, and she used her persona, her international reputation, her force of personality, and her relationship with the president to constantly push for policies that came from her subordinates in the State Department. And her fingerprints are on many of America's assertive global stances, including, for instance, intervention in Libya. But ultimately, she was put in a position to rely on herself. But the mechanisms and the structure, the way that decision making at the White House was set up, was not set up for allowing the diplomats and the State Department to really have serious ownership of policy. So because that mechanism didn't work, because it was one way that the White House wanted to dominate policy and dictate what you do, that she would achieve things by basically going around the structure, and that worked. Mm. It worked often, but that's not the way to actually run policy.
We're almost up in a break here, but you're right. The administration made it extremely difficult for his own foreign policy experts to be heard.
Which is exactly the case, that you appoint somebody like Richard Holbrooke with his legacy, and then you not only don't listen to him, but you actually don't allow him to meet with the president one-on-one. And then you also undermine him with the very countries and people that he's supposed to be doing his job with, like with President of Afghanistan or with the Pakistanis. And that, I think, in the eyes of the world, made a charade of our Afghanistan strategy off the bat.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Vali Nasr is our guest today on Radio Times. The last time he was on was in something like 2006, when he wrote a book called The Shia Revival. His new book is called The Dispensable Nation: American Foreign Policy in Retreat. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project, a world premiere comedy written and directed by Jennifer Childs. Featuring an eclectic cast of Philadelphia actresses, It's My Party, the Women and Comedy Project dives into the many roles comedy plays in women's lives, exploring and exposing the real comedy of everyday life. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscowen, reminding you that your financial support makes all the difference here at WHYY. We get more than half of our budget from you when you make a pledge of support. 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. You're listening to Radio Times, a program that talks about everything. Today, U.S. foreign policy and poetry. How cool is that? 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Princeton Medicine proudly supports WHYY. Princeton Medicine brings together primary care physicians, specialists, and surgeons from throughout central New Jersey, all on staff at Princeton Healthcare System to help provide greater access and coordinated care. Their specialties range from cardiology and geriatrics to cancer care, obstetrics and gynecology, and more. To find a Princeton Medicine doctor, 1-800-FINDADR or online at findadr.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Vali Nasser, Dean of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, also non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. And from 2009 to 2011, he was a senior advisor to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, working on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that's what he writes about in his new book called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. And that phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. Let me quote from the Wall Street Journal, a review of your book. This is James Traub talking about Richard Holbrooke. And he says, with a critique of you, for starters, he, Vali Nasser, neglects to mention the fact that Holbrooke did serious damage to his standing in the Obama administration when he openly backed the opposition in the 2009 Afghan election, thus outraging incumbent Afghan President Hamid Karzai, the eventual winner. Is that a fair description?
No. Largely because it was the policy of the United States going all the way up to the president to basically get tough with Karzai on corruption, governance, and democratic issues. The problem was that Karzai fully well knew that the president did not have Holbrooke's back. The problem was not that Holbrooke antagonized Karzai. The problem was that Karzai fully well knew that he could disrespect Holbrooke and he could push back and nothing would happen. And in fact, the White House would take advantage of Karzai's pushback to undermine Holbrooke. Before Holbrooke had a tense meeting with President Karzai, Vice President Biden on one occasion, in a very difficult conversation, got up in the middle of a dinner in Kabul and walked out after reading a riot act to President Karzai. But President Karzai would not dare to show his displeasure with the Vice President of the United States. So it really went to the fact that the president appointed this czar and then made it clear globally that he wasn't backing him.
But it sounds like the way you describe how he was ignored and dismissed, and the fact that he had supported Hillary Clinton in the run-up, the Democratic primary for president, that it was personal, or perhaps personal with these aides that kept Holbrooke at arm's length.
Well, it was personal, but it got more personal because Holbrooke would refuse to give up on advocating policy. If he was just going to be a yes man and take whatever the White House gave, and never try to suggest things, never try to push for policy, never try to disrupt their narrative and to say, well, you know, we should look at this and we should look at that and I should say this, then it would have been fine. Mm-hmm. But Holbrooke simply refused to do that, and he refused to cede control of Afghanistan-Pakistan policy to the White House. And that made it really personal.
Let me throw out one more thing. This is coming back to that same Wall Street Journal review saying that, talking about Holbrooke's grandiosity and blatant big-footing that cost Holbrooke some would-be allies, including Carl Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He was exhausted by SWAP's incessant demands and vexed by his habit of bullying embassy staff.
Well, first of all, that kind of a complaint runs both ways. There's plenty of complaints also about the way the embassy behaved. But again, the issue is not whether Holbrooke had sharp elbows with people next to him. The problem was that was his relationship with the president. He clearly was not antagonistic towards the president. He clearly was managed up very well. And the issue is not whether or not he was able to push for a particular policy with the embassy. The problem was that he couldn't be heard on the macro policy at the White House. So again, you know, this is misplaced, because my point is not whether, you know, on the policy of planting pomegranates in Kandahar, Holbrooke antagonized the embassy. The issue is that the State Department and its chief Afghanistan-Pakistan person was not allowed to have the kind of access and relationship with the president and the kind of access to policymaking that he should have had. The problem is, in other words, Holbrooke's relationship upwards, not sideways and downwards.
But do you think he was then some kind of window dressing for the president, who had certainly campaigned on negotiations and diplomacy?
Yes, I think increasingly that was the case. And in fact, we are now talking about reconciliation with the Taliban, but it's all an afterthought. It's sort of a ribbon that we're putting around a policy that we already have decided on, but is not contingent on whether or not we actually arrive at a settlement with them.
I wonder, though, and your book is, you know, clearly and legitimately critical of the Obama administration, but I wonder whether the Bush administration bears some responsibility as well in the way it conducted the war in Afghanistan and then leaving Afghanistan to go into Iraq.
It bears huge responsibility. But this is not about my book is not about litigating history. This is about the challenges we face now and going forward. And I don't think an excuse, bad policies by the Bush administration, gives us a pass not to get our foreign policy right going forward. In the end, we face challenges in the world that are alive and are critical, and a debate with the past is not a way to address those problems. We should learn from the past, and we should formulate proper policies. But and I think it doesn't do us service to say every time we come up on a problem to say, well, Bush was worse at it. Mm. Yes, let's concede he was. Now what?
When U.S. troops leave, it seems that they will leave behind a drone policy, or certainly drones, mm-hmm. and also special forces. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I'm not sure that that's even sustainable on the ground. We would have to pay a huge amount of bribes to Pakistan and Afghanistan to sustain that program, and it's possible that it may not work. But I think drones are very important. Special forces are important in containing terrorism, but they're not substitute for real engagement with the region. And I think as we keep expanding the drones from Pakistan to Yemen, now to Somalia, to, I guess, eventually Syria, Libya, you know, wherever we see footprint of al-Qaeda, it begs the question, can this program bombing from the air on a continuous basis, is it politically really viable?
Politically in this country?
No, I mean on the ground. In this country is a whole different issue. Right. But this is sort of an ongoing hot war. This is aerial bombardment of territories with or without government consent that ultimately will not be accepted by publics in those countries. And it would be a breakpoint. And I think, and this was Holbrooke's view, that if you're going to do that, you better be having other relationship with these people as well, so that would provide some countervailing benefits to them. If you don't want to be engaged at all in the Middle East and you just want to drone your threats away, this is not going to work.
I do want to move on to Pakistan, but even just looking at Afghanistan, do you think it's too late for any kind of negotiations? The kind of stakeholders in that region, and it's even beyond Afghanistan itself, that there are issues which people can discuss around a table, or have we lost that opportunity?
I think unless we change our strategy, we've lost that opportunity. Because why would the Taliban talk to us? We've already said we're leaving. Why would the Pakistanis change the strategy? We've already said we're leaving. So everybody's basically saying, waiting for us to actually leave, and then they're going to try to take care of their own issues their own way, which might lead to civil war at some level or a return of the Taliban. You know, if you're going to be mediating negotiation, you have to have leverage. And our leverage came from the fact that we said, we're here in the long run. We're not going to go away. You have to deal with us. If you want us to leave, you better negotiate our departure. Now we're departing without negotiations. So I don't see any reason why people would talk to us.
Is money leverage?
But we're not willing to do that either. Yes, money is leverage. But I think we're going to end up using money to sustain our drone program. And once we don't have a footprint, I think the price is going to keep going up. We have to pay more and more in order to be able to use the skies over Pakistan and Afghanistan and bases in the region to conduct these operations.
And the price meaning bribes, as you mentioned earlier?
Right, because ultimately you have to get the consent of these governments for your policy. And the trend there has been that we have paid for our policy, but I think the price will go higher.
And that's Vali Nasser, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's dean of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, and the author of a new book called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. That book was excerpted a couple of weeks ago and caused quite a stir. And we are talking about some of the issues and ideas in this book. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You have a fascinating chapter. Well, there are many fascinating chapters in this book, one titled Who Lost Pakistan, describing a conversation with President Zardari, you and Richard Holbrooke. And Zardari says, Pakistan is like AIG, too big to fail. Help us understand this conversation.
Well, what President Zardari was basically saying is that you're really, for everything you want from Pakistan, you're really not paying anything. You're giving some money to the military very narrowly, but to have a real relationship, but also to turn Pakistan around, you have to pay a lot more. And he used this argument that, you know, you were willing to put $100 billion into AIG, and your logic was that the problem is too big to let it go sideways and fail. Pakistan is a country of 180 million people in a geostrategic region with nuclear weapons, with a lot of extremism. You ought to think of it like AIG, and you have to treat it like AIG, which means that you have to invest very big in it to turn it around. Although Ambassador Holbrooke sort of thought to himself, yes, but the CEO of AIG gets $1 a year in salary now and can be fired by the board if he doesn't perform. So the $100 billion to AIG is not quite free money or money without very strict conditionality. But I think it's, as Zardari still really raised an important issue, which is this is a very critical country. But we've assumed that we can have a transactional relationship with it, show up when we have a need, pay the minimum for what we want, and then have an expectation that on a shoestring sort of contribution, we can actually change its foreign policy and really turn the country around. And I think that's an important point for us to think about.
Shoestring, I mean, we are talking about billions of dollars here. I mean, they get not as much as Israel, but they get a fair amount of money from the
United States. No, but most of that money is strict money, which is for services rendered by the military. It was only during the Obama administration that for the first time the Congress passed a five-year, multi-year civilian aid package, most of which will now not be funded because of both the breakdown in the relationship and our budget cuts. But in the past, most of the money went to the military. It went for specific things like the drone program, like having access to using their roads to access Afghanistan. So it's very little money. I mean, average Pakistani doesn't really see anything from the U.S. I remember a Pakistani minister once told Holbrooke, I can point to the Chinese bridge. I can point to the Chinese highway. I can't point to anything you've built since the 1960s in this country.
And you're saying something as tangible of that as that would change the perspective on the United States?
I think the Pakistanis public has to see a tangible benefit in this relationship. The way they see it is that this relationship is one way. It's about things America wants and doesn't even really want to pay for it. And it's America also doesn't want to be really connected to Pakistan long run. Its strategic interests lie with India. So whatever America wants in this region doesn't even address Pakistan's strategic vulnerabilities. So, you know, we've never asked, why would Pakistan want a stable Afghanistan under President Karzai?
Why would they want a stable?
Why? I mean, Pakistan has only felt safe with Afghanistan during the Taliban era. Whenever you've had a strong government in Kabul, it's always had eyes on Pakistan's Pashtun areas, and it's always been an ally of India. So for the Pakistanis, terrorism is a lesser evil next door than a strong Afghan government. And nothing we're doing in Afghanistan actually addresses Pakistan's vulnerabilities. Actually, on the other side, it actually aggravated them.
But just picking, and it's often called AFPAC. I mean, the idea that these two countries are so so linked together. So if you had a weak government in Afghanistan, that would be good for Pakistan?
Well, weak government, yes, it would be good for Pakistan. But weak government that they could either control or at least could control large swaths of southern Afghanistan as a sort of a buffer zone. Pakistanis are convinced that sooner or later, if they don't control southern Afghanistan, there's going to be a division of Indian troops stationed there, and they would have to face India on two fronts. So for Pakistan, Afghanistan is all about India and is all about Pashtun separatism. It's a much bigger issue than extremism and terrorism. Now, the Pakistanis have used a wrong strategy for dealing with this, which is investing in the Taliban. Right. But we're not, you know, giving him a couple of $1 billion a year is not enough to really capture the country's attention and really get it to think about an alternative strategy.
How much, though, do you think the fact that Osama bin Laden was found in Abbottabad, inside of Pakistan, that has tainted the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan?
Oh, it's tainted it enormously. And I think the relationship is pretty much broken. But the question is, yes, we have legitimate grievances against Pakistan. We are right to be angry. But we also have to understand that you cannot just wash your hands off of a country of 180 million people with nuclear arms and the degree of problems and extremism that Pakistan has. And Zardari is right. It's just too big for us to ignore, and it's too big for us to countenance that it could fail. So whether we like it or not, we have to put our shoulder to getting Pakistan to a more stable place. And that's not out of a sort of a charitable, philanthropic urge on our part. It is really out of self-interest that we ought to think about that.
Not an easy thing to do.
easy thing to do. But look, a lot of the challenges we face around the world are not easy. Mm. And we shouldn't put ourselves in a position of only dealing with these things when, you know, you have a volcanic eruption. We have to really think a little bit ahead.
But and we're almost up in our second break here. But you're talking about something concrete, bridges, roads, things that people can see, and also developing a workable relationship with specific certain people in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, to have a much more of a normal relationship, which means that it should have a military security component, but it should have a civilian economic component as well. And we have to sort of gradually invest on having more influence in Pakistan, more relationship with people. If we are really going to buy their foreign policy, we better be prepared to pay the right price in the right way. And at least we shouldn't fool ourselves to think that what we have with the Pakistan military is really big enough or significant enough to change their foreign policy.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation again. Vali Nasser is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We've been covering a lot of territory today on the show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Camp Hill's special school is hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on April 27th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're in the very first few hours of the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. And just like you, we've had to tighten our belts and we have to pay our bills. And that's where you come in. We're thrilled that you listen. We'd be even happier when you become a member. It's very simple. Decide what Radio Times and all the programs here at WHYY is worth and then make a call. 1-888-345-9499 or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks so much.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and reminds women 40 years of age and older of the importance of annual mammograms. To schedule a mammogram at the Chester County Hospital's nationally accredited breast center, 610-431-5131.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, Vali Nasser is our guest on the show, author of a new book called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We could do the whole hour on each one of your chapters here, but let me quote something in your chapter about the Arab Spring. You say, the United States does not need to get it right everywhere, but it cannot afford to get it wrong in Egypt. Have we gotten it wrong in Egypt?
I think so, because I think we have been fairly disengaged from Egypt after the fall of Mubarak. So we do intervene when a crisis erupts, like shootings in the Sinai Peninsula or a constitutional crisis. But by and large, we really have not been deeply engaged, particularly on the economic side, which is very critical. We learned from Eastern Europe, from other democratizations, that economic reforms early on is very important. You have to get the international community in. You have to show these countries a roadmap to economic reform, and you have to put resources on the table. And none of those are there for Egypt. Last week, Egypt was negotiating with the IMF, and the United States has no position, no involvement. Qatar and Libya came in last minute and undermined the talks by giving money to Egypt to be able to do things without actually conducting reforms. And without reforms, Egypt will sink. Between 2011, when Mubarak left, and today, there are a million more Egyptians that are unemployed. Mm. And this trend will continue unless there is a change in Egypt's economic structure, unless it does what Poland and Brazil and Argentina did right after democratization. And we're not a part of that conversation, really.
Let me just throw in Iraq and going back a decade, the Bush administration wanting to bring democracy to Iraq, attempted to bring it through the invasion. And I think a lot of people in this country have gotten kind of cold feet that this country, this dispensable nation, as you describe it, can change another country, that we have the kind of influence and clout to make a country do something one way or the other.
Well, we cannot go and tell a country to adopt a political system, but we have in the past helped countries change. And I think economics is the most important part of that. You help a country change its economic structure and that country changes. We forget that the Arab Spring was the product of the middle class. It's the middle class in Egypt and Tunisia that went out, that used Facebook and Twitter and really made this happen. In Iran in 2009, the Green Movement was led by the middle class. The middle class, just like middle classes everywhere, is tied to private sector. You have to create a private sector. To create a private sector, you have to do IMF kind of reforms. Mm. When Eastern Europe fell, when Mexico was going through a democratic transition, we were there on the first day on a get-go. We put big money on the table. We got the IMF involved. We pushed for economic reforms. And whatever happened politically, those countries' systems were changed forever. If you look at Eastern Europe, the United States, IMF, and international community put $100 billion into Eastern Europe between 89 and 99. When Mexico was facing change, the Treasury, Goldman Sachs, and IMF put $40 billion into the Mexican economy. Look at how much money we've put into Egypt, and look at how much leadership we've shown around the world to get others to put money into Egypt. The sum total would not even get to a billion. And it's obvious why those countries decided to go down the path of IMF reforms. There might be many reasons, ideological, geostrategic, but one very clear reason was that there was a real economic package led by the United States with commitment to an economic future on the table. And I think we spend $1 trillion trying to change this region through war, and we're not willing to pay, you know, 4 months of Afghanistan war to change Egypt.
Let me ask you about China. We're going around the world here. But one of the theses or thesi in your book is about if and when and how the U.S. retreats from the world, that China is moving in to fill the vacuum. And if we're focusing on the Middle East, obviously China, this growing economy, looking for oil, looking for energy to power its economy. How do you see China's vision as opposed to the U.S.?
Well, China's vision for the Middle East is no different than China's vision for Africa or Latin America. They look at Middle East as a rising strategic concern. They look at energy resources of Central Asia and the Persian Gulf. They look at the Middle East as a massive market with a very big middle class and a lot of purchasing power. They also look at Middle East as geostrategic because as China's industrial and population centers move west, the countries of the Middle East and Central Asia, the arc from Central Asia to Afghanistan and Pakistan, becomes more important to them as the area that really sits right on their borders of Western China. And the Chinese are investing in pipelines, in roads, in infrastructure, in manufacturing. They're building political ties. They're not doing that to replace the United States. They're just looking at Middle East as an area of expansion. Now, we have decided that the big game globally is between us and China, mm-hmm. but somehow we've decided that that game is going to be played only in the Asia-Pacific. So we understand Asia to be really Asia-Pacific, whereas Chinese understand Asia to be, well, Asia, everything from the Mediterranean to the Sea of Japan. And as we're pivoting east, they're pivoting west. And somehow this foreign policy that we've adopted, which is premised on the idea that Middle East matters less and Asia matters more, and is a sort of a binary choice between the Middle East and Asia, I don't think really addresses the reality out there, which is that we have to deal with China's global presence economically, diplomatically, politically, and that's from Africa to the Middle East. And the Middle East has been an area of the world where actually we've had a lot of equities. And as we are trying to shrink our footprint there, that basically means mm-hmm. that the countries in the region are going to say, well, if you're not going to be here, we're going to look at those who are here, and China increasingly emerges on the radar.
And is that because China has money and the U.S. is dealing with, the after effects of a pretty serious recession?
Well, that's partly it. China has money, but China is willing to invest. But also, China's just developing its tentacles in the region. It is not just that it's giving money. It's also buying a lot. And it's investing in a long relationship with many countries in the region. And that ultimately will make it a presence. And that presence is going to look a lot larger if American presence looks smaller.
Let me quote, we've been covering, as I said, a fair number of territories, and this is Iran. You had an op-ed in the New York Times in March headlined, "Why Iran May Be Ready to Deal." Let me just quote something here. "The United States should shift from trying to further intimidate Iran to trying to clinch an agreement. The sanctions have given America leverage, and we should use it to seek a deal that would finally restrict Iran's ability to build, to make bomb fuel, rather than ratchet up the pressure in the hopes of getting either a broad deal now or total surrender later." What do you mean?
Well, I mean that we use sanctions to get Iran to the table. And they have come three or four sessions mm-hmm. to negotiations. But sanctions alone is not going to get Iran to abandon its program. So we have to put something concrete on the table. I mean, concrete sanctions we're willing to barter for things we want Iran to stop doing. We use the sanctions as pressure. They want sanctions lifted. That's what they want to barter over, and we should barter. But right now, we haven't put any of that on the table. So the only things that we've tangibly offered Iran in these negotiations are aircraft parts and consideration, future consideration for their good behavior now. But that's not really serious negotiating position. And I think Iranians are deciding that if they really want these sanctions to go away, would they get that through negotiations with the United States? If they decide that that's not going to happen through negotiations, I think they're going to invest in actually getting to a bomb because they would see that as better leverage in getting rid of sanctions. They're looking at North Korea, for instance, who's very clearly using its nuclear saber rattling to get concessions out of South Korea and the United States. So I think the moment is now when Iran can go either down a path of serious negotiations or down a path of bomb making. And I think that requires to get serious with diplomacy. Sanctions have reached a point. They've done their job. They've brought them to the table. Now you got to use the sanctions to actually achieve results.
And that's Vali Nasser, our guest today in Radio Times, author of a new book called The Dispensable Nation, and it's subtitled American Foreign Policy in Retreat. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me ask you about Syria. And the United States has been reluctant to overtly support the rebels, such as they are, providing less weaponry and more other kinds of support. Do you think the U.S. should get more deeply involved in the rebel cause against the Syrian government?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. can start by being much more serious about humanitarian assistance. There are now a million refugees. They can be 3 million. They can destabilize the countries around them. The economy of Jordan or Lebanon really cannot take care of these refugees. We can at least start by making sure that the fallout from Syria is no more destructive than it need be. Secondly, we can actually put our shoulder to getting the Syrian opposition in line and stop the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Qatar that has made the opposition very ineffective. We could get much more serious with diplomacy with China and Russia, try to find a common ground around the ceasefire, for instance, as a starting point. And then I think you begin to talk about what we need to do militarily. I think it does make sense to arm the rebels because the Assad government has to understand that we cannot win this war on the battlefield. But I also think that it is better for the United States to do this directly than to rely on other powers to do it. The lesson of Afghanistan for us ought to be that it's always better for us to arm directly than let others do it. It was allowing Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to arm the Mujahideen that caused a lot of the problems that we encountered after we left that area.
One of the critiques is that when you look at the rebels in Syria, that you're talking about a diverse group of people, some that might have ties to Al-Qaeda. Is that worrisome to you?
It is. And the reason that those groups have become so powerful is exactly because we've been late to the game. The Al-Qaeda groups gained influence because they were the source of weapons for a long time. So they were able to co-opt many other groups because they could provide them with weaponry. And end of the day, the question is, well, what is our solution for this empowerment of Al-Qaeda? Either we or somebody has to literally invade Syria and flush them out, or you have to find some rebel groups that would begin to elbow out the Al-Qaeda groups. And how are you going to strengthen them? And clearly, without us getting involved in some way, not necessarily doing it all ourselves, but at least we have to take leadership here. We have to we have to get everybody else on board and on the same page, following the same sheet of music, if we are going to be doing this right.
How would you describe President Obama's foreign policy, or is that part of the problem?
I think generally he has not been focused on foreign policy, and he has not viewed it as very important. And I think he has adopted a posture of that doing less is more. Some of this comes from a perception of the way it reflects in domestically. But we don't need to lead in the world. We can allow others to take command, others should charge ahead, and then, as the phrase that became famous, we can lead from behind or lead when necessary, when others have done that. Well, it doesn't happen. We can see it with Syria. Others can't get their act together to do this. American leadership is necessary. So America has been cautious. It's been timid. It has viewed foreign policy as too risky and with risks that are not worth taking. And when it's come to really spending domestic political capital on convincing the American people why they might need to do hard things, that the administration has been reluctant to argue to the American people why Egypt, Pakistan, or Syria matters.
So, and about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but so from your perspective, the U.S. should be an indispensable nation? I mean, that's really our role in the world.
Well, I think we have seen ourselves in this way, Republican or Democrat, and the world has seen us this way, even though they've complained about us and many of our policies. But if we want to put ourselves in a position where the world looks at us and say they are dispensable, they're not here, they're not engaged, we're on our own, we got to figure it out on our own, are we really prepared for that? Do we really understand what the consequences of that is? So my aim with this book is to let us discuss that. We ought to do this with eyes wide open.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Vali Nasr. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me
here. You're very welcome. And he's the Dean of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we've been talking about his new book called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.